This is Sustainable East End, a show about land use, energy and water resources, transportation, and the farming and food industries on the eastern end of Long Island. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, here with Tony Ernst. Today we talk about the Ecological Culture Initiative, a new organization devoted to restoring sustainability to the Hampton Bays community. The group's goal is to provide models for an alternative to destructive land use practices and growth-based development that damage the health of the local aquifer, soil, and waterways. The Ecological Culture Initiative has several projects underway, including a seed-sharing program that will launch this spring at the Hampton Bays Local Library, and the screening of the film Seeds, The Untold Story, tomorrow evening. Co-host Tony Ernst and I talked with Mark Fasanella, director of the Ecological Culture Initiative. Mark Fasanella, welcome to Sustainable East End.
Thank you.
And we're also here with Tony Ernst.
Hello.
So the Ecological Culture Initiative, the website outlines an amazing number of projects of this Ecological Cultural Initiative. Tell us, give us a little snapshot of some of them, then we'll go in more deeply, and tell us what it's all about.
Sure. Well, what happened is we were having a lot of dinner conversations in this farmhouse that you're in about what are the things that are necessary to really make a community, what the phrase people use, sustainable. What would it really do? Because we have a serious water quality problem in Hampton Bays. We're surrounded by water, and there's a lot of attention being drawn to the die-offs that have happened in the bays. And so we're just talking and talking and talking. Richard Casabianco owns this house, has been a kind of lifelong historian and preservationist. And then I've been teaching ecological design at Stony Brook University for the past 8 years. So the more we thought about it, the more we realized it was all of these efforts to kind of look back through the past. One of my students, Nick Zanussi, who was from the East End, said that one of the things we have to do is kind of stop and let the past catch up to us before we rush headlong into the future. So we kind of look at all the best aspects of what we had in the past, and then I've been teaching the most advanced regenerative principles, the kinds of things we can do to create the built environment that actually collaborates with the ecosystem instead of imposing on the ecosystem. So we put all those ideas together, and we looked at the different nonprofits that are serving the East End, and Hampton Bays really wasn't getting as much attention as some other communities. Peconic Land Trust does fantastic work. Group for the East End does fantastic work. Peconic Estuary Program. I mean, all of those nonprofits do great work, but Hampton Bays doesn't get a lot of their attention because it's not a farming community. Traditionally, it was a farming community, and that's something that we want to bring back. We want to have more local gardening and small farms in Hampton Bays to augment the fishing. And then people use the phrase ecotourism. Hampton Bays was probably a very early ecotourism place. People came out here to get out into the ecosystem, go into the woods and spend time in nature, to sail. And so that's the kind of culture we want to restore to Hampton Bays, and then have the built environment advance in ways. For instance, there's no building code that says we should have passive solar buildings, but that's the kind of thing I think we should have in Hampton Bays, and we have some models. Laura Luciano, who's on our advisory board and a food writer, her husband's an architect, and they have a passive solar house. So these things, you know, exist in Hampton Bays. There is one small farm that we hope to begin giving worth, a couple of small farms. Our agroecology director, Rachel Stevens, has a small farm, but there's one traditional one. So we want to kind of restore those elements of the past, both the architectural history, the farming history, the history of people coming out to actually enjoy the ecosystem, not necessarily on a big machine, but just by spending time in nature. And that's what the Ecological Culture Initiative was founded to do.
So ecological design, what are the basic ideas that underlie it?
So rain harvesting, rainwater collection, there's really no reason we should be building any building in the 21st century that isn't harvesting rain, because the water that we're using both for irrigation and for our showers and as well as cooking and drinking comes from a thousands of year old aquifer. That's a pristine drinking water source, and we're using it at an alarmingly fast rate. Development has not stopped. We're still creating new developments all over Long Island, and we're pulling tons of water out of this to sprinkle it in our lawns, add fertilizer, petrochemical fertilizer, and fungicides and pesticides to it, and then flush it down storm drains as fast as we possibly can, back as close to that aquifer as fast as we can. So that's one example of ecological design. It's very simple. Every new building that should be made, every major renovation should harvest the rain that falls onto its roof. And then there are many other surfaces where we could harvest rain. Any non-permeable surface, roadway, pathways, we could be harvesting that rain. And then the principle there is to slow it down and then soak it into a complex biodiverse ecosystem before it sinks down towards the aquifer. Not have it, you know, shunt as fast as possible towards a storm drain, as close as possible as we can get it to the aquifer. So that's one example, passive solar design being another. And then landscape schemes and concepts of landscape that are far more biodiverse. The lawns that we have all over Long Island, all over the United States, if we look at Long Island, probably our number one crop is grass. And we're fertilizing it, and we're importing those fertilizers. Whereas a landscape that actually produces clean air and produces water, clean water for us, would have much, much greater biodiversity than that. So that's one of the other principles, is creating xeriscapes, landscapes that don't require any additional water or fertilizer than what is already in place. There are many, many plants that are adapted to this landscape. Victoria Bustamante, who is one of the owners of Warren's Nursery, is a one of many local native plant experts. And so she is working with Edwina von Gaal, who is in the East Hampton, is another one. But so those are the kinds of initiatives we want to get to happen. And we're working with the Hampton Bays Beautification Association right now to put a rain garden right in the center of Hampton Bays.
A rain garden.
Yeah, so what we want to do is take the rain off of a municipal building. We don't have all the permissions yet, so I won't say which building, but take all the rain that comes off a roof of a building right in the center of town, and then have one of these demonstration rain gardens so people can see the types of plants, the type of landscape, and they really have to be beautiful. There are other rain gardens on the East End, but not all of them are the type that somebody would walk by and say, "Ooh, I want that in front of my house." So we really want to make this a beautiful demonstration garden. The Parish Art Museum has some large, pretty developed examples of them along the walkways as you enter the museum. Those are all permeable surfaces and landscapes, and all the water that comes off the parking lots actually gets filtered through the plants before it gets down towards the aquifer.
Can we just back up a bit, Mark? Where are you from? What did you do before you got involved in this group?
So I was born and raised in Westchester County, north of the city, and my parents were lifelong activists. My mother was a public school teacher, and my father was a self-taught social realist painter. So I had people like Cesar Chavez and Pete Seeger in my house as I was growing up, and I became exposed to how people can really change the communities they live in and affect change. As far as my profession, I was trained to be a public school industrial arts and technology teacher. And over the years throughout my education, I apprenticed myself to estate gardening and restoration carpentry. And then I taught at Southampton College for 15 years. I taught graphic design and other design classes. And then when Southampton College closed, it was a very dark chapter of my life. I was transferred to CW Post. But I decided I didn't want to do that. And like a ray of sunshine, a bolt of lightning, the state bought that Southampton campus and opened an environmental college, which is what I originally had wanted to do as a professor. So when they opened this environmental college, I jumped at the chance to work for Stony Brook Southampton. And then, of course, after a couple of years, the president of the Stony Brook University changed. They kind of downsized the Stony Brook Southampton campus, and I was shifted to a program at the main campus, the sustainability program. And I've been teaching in that program for 8 years. I just left that position, and it is in that position that I taught ecological art, architecture, and design. There are artists today who are using natural processes as their medium. And that's the kind of art that I was teaching. The design, as I was saying, the built environment, the landscape, how we create the landscape, how we create buildings that collaborate with ecosystems instead of imposing themselves or even integrating themselves, really collaborating with natural processes. And then the design really even goes to community behavioral systems. Buckminster Fuller said that environmental design is not only building a better physical environment for humankind, but also reforming behavioral patterns. So to give an example of that, I say this all the time, people roll their eyes and think I'm crazy for saying it, but Chesapeake Bay and other areas have studied what creates this excess nitrogen that's affecting our waterways on the at East End, they had the same thing in the Chesapeake Bay. And one of the leading causes is meat consumption. So if we really cared about our ecosystem, we would eat less meat.
connect the dots.
Well, if you think about it, when you're eating meat, it's a whole lot of resources that keep getting condensed and condensed and condensed. So there's a tremendous amount of water, a tremendous amount of grain, a tremendous amount of nutrients that go into creating that ounce of meat that you're eating. And so it's a much more intense, it's harder for you to digest, and it produces more nitrogen in your urine in particular. And that's really the most dangerous thing. So we could adapt our diets to be, and that's just one example. The other would be other consumption practices. For instance, in the marinas, there's a tremendous amount of detergents being used and cleaning boats and waxing boats and, you know, and all of the processes that we use around our waterways. We should be extremely careful about what we're putting into our waterways. And the bulkheads and, you know, all the ways we look at that, we can really change our personal practices and the foods that we buy, too. So the more local the foods are, the greater we're increasing biodiversity. And you want to have farms that you know are using what's called polyculture, as opposed to having hundreds of acres in one type of crop. You want to have many, many crops. So Biophilia Farm on the North Fork is one of many examples where he does that kind of farming.
I love that name, Biophilia.
It's a great guy, Phil Manuele from Biophilia Farm.
If you've just joined Sustainable East End, we're talking with Mark Fasanella of the Ecological Culture Initiative in Hampton Bays. So now tell us about some of the projects. You have a permaculture education center. Define permaculture for us and tell us what the center does.
Sure. That's our ultimate goal, is we'd actually like to make Hampton Bays a college town that has an academic program in it that is based in understanding and learning about these issues. So permaculture was invented by Bill Mollison in the 70s. And what he and a colleague did was they looked at all these different agricultural systems from around the world and tried to put them together and create a system, instead of agriculture, that would be a self-replenishing system, a regenerative system. And they came up with that term, permaculture. So I'm hoping next January, a year from now, we'll be offering a permaculture certificate. I just, in Hampton Bays, I've been talking with a couple of property owners, and it looks like we have a property selected. And we just signed an agreement, the Ecological Culture Initiative, with the LIU Post Center for Sustainability. Scott Carlin, who runs that center, lives in Hampton Bays. And so we plan to bring that program to Hampton Bays. We have meetings with politicians over the next few weeks, and we'll start raising funds to create a permanent permaculture center and then build out academic programs around that. So that, we're in the process of designing that, and we could sure use some help with fundraising for that project, and if people have any suggestions as to grants or people would like to donate to that type of a project. But starting very small and locally, the first thing that we did was we actually have created a seed library. Rachel Stevens, our agroecology director, has created this fantastic seed library that'll open on March 8th at the Hampton Bays Public Library. It's open to anyone. The seeds are free. And that we're trying to, once again, get more and more of this type of biodiversity of food in our local ecosystem.
So people can just go to, how does that work?
So there are many companies around the world that are trying to deal with this. There's a huge loss of biodiversity in foodstuffs. So there are many seed companies that are working hard, and they've been donating seeds to us. And what we're going to take those donated seeds and give them out to local people. You get about 10 to 20 seeds, depending on the size of the seeds, in a small packet. They're free. We're going to have classes on how to germinate them and propagate the plants and harvest. And then hopefully we can get community members to collect seeds, and you eventually create an ecotype. You start to get seeds that are hybridized on their own to the place where you live. They adapt to the conditions where you live. So that's really the ultimate goal of a seed library, is having this ongoing program. And so that's what we're starting at the Hampton Bays Public Library.
Well, that's wonderful. You also have the Good Ground Seed Library. You also have the Good Ground Restoration Project.
So that's really the umbrella term we're using for all of these efforts. If you think about restoration, It's not the same thing as renovation. And we've been doing a lot of renovation. So, for instance, in Hampton Bays, most of the houses were cedar-sided, and almost all of that's getting covered as new places are constructed with vinyl siding. Vinyl siding is an incredibly destructive product in its manufacture. It's very dangerous, the production process for the workers in the factory, and then there is absolutely no way to recycle it or use it for anything but landfill. People always say, well, it's maintenance-free. Not so much. If you look at the PVC fences and the vinyl siding, people have to power wash them. The hurricanes that we get take a tremendous toll and kind of rip them off the side of the houses at times, and it's difficult to find the exact same material to replace it with. So sometimes people recite a whole wall, and then we have dumpsters full of all this material. So that's really gives you an idea of the restoration project, is looking at those. We could be sustainably harvesting cedar on the east end of Long Island. Cedar trees are indigenous trees. Now, that's something that would take years to do, but that's the kind of thing. So it's a regenerative advanced practice, actually farming. In fact, research has been done that now shows that the most sustainable building is built out of wood, because you can't propagate cement or steel. They take thousands of years to create these mineral resources, whereas we could be inventing and developing and revisiting all of these practices of sustainable farming that we have as a species used for thousands of years. It's really only after World War II that the experiment we have now of trying all these new materials and always coming up with what we think is a panacea. So the vinyl siding is not a panacea. It doesn't last forever. It needs maintenance. It's difficult to replace. Whereas if we look back at some of the other building materials, which isn't to say that we shouldn't have any new building materials, but that really is the idea of the restoration project. And the same with gardening and wooden boat building. There's a great little... I have a piece where we talk about the history of Hampton Bays. And if you looked at Hampton Bays in the 19th century, every yard was full of fruit trees. Children on the way home from school, there's a woman, Pat Tuccio, who's a member of the Hampton Bays Historical Society and Preservation Society board. And she recalls from her time growing up, walking by and just being able to pick berries from people's yards. There were tons of blueberries and strawberries. And so that's the kind of thing we mean by restoring those practices.
Of course, now you have the deer, and they get to the berries the fruit before we do.
I think there's two things. The development has been growing. We haven't stopped developing. There's a lot of lots for sale in Hampton Bays. One of the projects we're working on, we have a great land analyst. He's a student in the Environmental Design Policy and Planning major at Stony Brook University, R.J. Theofeld. We've been looking at, through GIS mapping, all of the undeveloped parcels that we have in Hampton Bays. So if we started to see all these undeveloped parcels as a corridor, and started actually planting out blueberries and the other things that deer eat, it will attract them away. I mean, they've evolved to eat people's gardens because they've been pushed out of the traditional places. But we really have a contiguous natural landscape and could augment. So, for instance, this parcel that's around us, there are invasive species like Norway maples that are pushing out all of the local plants. So when a Norway maple goes up and gets full, it'll be a full size, 30, 60 foot in diameter tree, you'll see absolutely nothing growing around its roots because it actually puts out a toxins through its roots. And the way the crown forms of the tree, it sheds all the rain to the ground around it, so that's very dry underneath it. And that's, so the deer are going to places where there's more food because we have invasive Norway maples and other plants that are pushing what they would have had originally evolved to eat. So they're evolving to eat things that we're putting in our gardens. So that's one strategy we can use, is actually looking at the entire landscape from the beach all the way to Hubbard Park and Smithers Park and Black Duck Lodge and the Squiretown Park in Hampton Bays, looking at all of that landscape as one contiguous ecological corridor and creating corridors for the deer to be able to feed, move, and have genetic biodiversity. So that's one of the practices we like to do is not only plant food for human beings, but also plant food for other species so that we increase the biodiversity and they become less of a pest to us and we become less of a pest to them.
This is Sustainable East End on WPKN Radio. We're talking with Mark Fasanella of the Ecological Culture Initiative in Hampton Bays. Now, you're talking about restoring a landscape, but we are now in a period of anthropogenic climate change. Hampton Bays is pretty low in terms of sea level. What are your thoughts on resilience, restoration in the face of sea level rise and climate change?
It sounds very radical in the context of the time we live in. But once again, if you look at the landscape that you see here, it's a post-World War II landscape. You could push it back to post-World War I, but really it's a post-World War II landscape. All of the houses that are right up, and we're still building new houses right up against the edge of the water. And that's just something that will have to change in the 21st century. The Community Preservation Fund was established by the state, and it's one of those opt-in programs where community can decide to create this tax on every real estate transfer. And there are funds available. And as these waterfront homes become available over the next 25, 50, 100 years, we need to purchase them and either pick them up and move them or take them down piece by piece and reuse those materials somewhere else and allow the marshes to come back in.
Mark, how do your neighbors feel about this, using the what was supposed to be a device to preserve open space being used to buy back the waterfront properties? How do people feel about that?
The Community Preservation Fund is not purchasing houses to create a more resilient landscape now. That's not a practice that is. I'm just saying that's something that could be done, and I think needs to be done in the 21st century. You know, people are resistant to change. Richard Casabianco, who owns this house, had a great phrase once at a community meeting. He said, there are two things that people despise, the way things are and change. So that's really, you know, you have to confront that and you have to confront it head on. It's not easy. And I'm not saying we're going to condemn people's houses and push them out of their houses. Ed Masuria, who wrote the first book on passive solar architecture in the United States, has an analysis he uses that over 30 years in the United States, 75% over 30 years, 75% of all buildings that you see in the landscape are either torn down and rebuilt or renovated beyond recognition. That's just what we do at human beings. So you have to have that 30-year, 50-year perspective and be saying, okay, well, when this family decides they can no longer afford the taxes on this house, you know, maybe that's when it's not a question of going in and condemning people's land and pushing them off their property. It's more a question of, once again, having this culture of understanding that we live in the water in Hampton Bays. We're surrounded by water. We're almost an island. If you look at the landscape, there's so much water around us. And it is going to rise. And we know what is called a slosh. The town has fantastic GIS mapping for where it will flood. We know where it will flood. So that's where we need to look first. Those are very easy things. And say, well, on these properties, we're going to make a priority of saying that the houses in this slosh area will, over time, and you just let the people who live there know that if you ever want to give up this house, let us know, and the town will give you fair market value for it.
Well, there's going to be at some point when insurers are not going to insure houses any longer.
I think that's true, and I think that's already happening. I mean, if you know the history of West Hampton Dunes, it had to be kind of self-insured. So I think that is happening. It's becoming, and of course, if you know the history of Hurricane Sandy, they said that it wasn't flood damage that happened to some of the houses, but wind-driven water. So even if you are insured, it doesn't mean that you're actually insured for your house and the damage that could be done in the storm.
Absolutely. So now let's talk about Seed, The Untold Story. This is a film that is going to air tomorrow. Talk about the film and where can people see it?
Sure. Seed is kind of a little bit of a movement as a documentary that's going around trying to get people to understand this issue. For years, there's been talk about the loss of biodiversity in food seeds in particular, especially grains and grains that are used for livestock. Michael Pollan, who's probably the world's most famous food writer, has said that, you know, corn might actually be using us as a vector as opposed to us propagating corn because it is the most grown crop in the universe. And then if you follow that up with rice and wheat, and if you use Google Earth, it's a fantastic tool and it really is worth doing. If you use Google Earth and you look around the Midwest United States, I mean, you will see miles and miles. The entire state of Ohio is basically just monocultures of either corn or soy or wheat. And so what's happening is the seed stock, the different types of plants, and of course that leaves us open to two things. It leaves us open to corporate exploitation in the sense that these seeds have been genetically modified to not self-propagate. So in other words, if a person plants corn and then they want to take some kernels of corn and replant it or rice, it won't properly grow the next season. You have to buy new seed stock from that manufacturer. And then they sell all kinds of products to use with that genetic modified seed to guarantee its high yield. And those are fertilizers and fungicides and pesticides. And then if you put other seed stock in that soil that you've used all of those products on, they won't propagate or have a high yield. So it's a real crisis in what we're doing in the land. And it is affecting waterways, entire rivers and aquifers, drinking aquifers. So that's really the issue of this film. And you'll see all of these activists who are both trying to preserve seeds. It's showing all the grassroots efforts like the Ecological Culture Initiative around the world. Kind of the leading proponent of that is Vandana Shiva. She's an Indian activist who's been working for years and in a fight against Monsanto in particular for really trying to monopolize seed stock in the same way that there's a few companies that own office software now, and that's the kind of market that we have. So this it's really an effort to push back against the tide of seeds being intellectual property and being something that you can patent. And of course, that's related to why we created the seed library in Hampton Bays. We're trying to do it at a very local level, and so are the activists in this movie. If you go to the ECI website, ecinY.org, the first thing you'll see is that logo, the image for seed, and there's a link right there. You have to buy the tickets through this link. It's an organization called Gather Us that is kind of a community organization, activist organization that's trying to get these screenings of this film around the country.
Well, that's terrific. Well, we've been talking with Mark Fasanella of the Ecological Culture Initiative. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Sustainable East End about this wonderful project.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Sustainable East End. On today's episode, we talked with Mark Fasanella of the Ecological Culture Initiative in Hampton Bays. The group will show the film Seeds, The Untold Story, tomorrow evening at the Hampton Bays Cinema. Information about obtaining tickets is online at the group's website, ecinY.org. Sustainable East End programs air each month on the third Wednesday and are archived at sustainableeastend.blogspot.com. Like us on Facebook at Sustainable East End.